Now, in viewing the information that was in the New York Times article from May 23rd of 1989, the fingering of a BND individual working for the PFLP is consistent with the hypothesis presented in December of 1988. Again, the December surprise hypothesis. And I think an examination of some of the historical background here will give us more of an understanding of how these things can come to pass. Now, again, even though the stated rationale, the official rationale behind using Marwan Krisat as an informant is to use Marwan Krisat basically in a counter-terror capacity, there are indications from past BND activities that people who are involved in counter-terror activities are very frequently involved in the very terrorist activities that they are supposed to be working against. We took a look in Radio Free America 22 at Hans Langemann, who worked for the BND, and Hans Langemann was the director of security for the 1972 Summer Olympics in Munich, Germany, where the Israeli athletes were killed. We took a look at Middle Eastern terrorist connections to that particular event, or the Middle Eastern organizations connected to that event, and their connection in turn to residual Third Reich elements and the Galen contingent to the Middle East that we're going to be looking at under Skorzeny. But again, the BND agent, the BND security person who was in charge of the Munich Olympics, Hans Langemann, worked with Hans Kolmar, head of the Bundeskriminalamt. That is the West German Federal Police, the equivalent of our FBI. Supposedly, they were putting together a group to infiltrate terrorist organizations in and around Germany, but in fact, it appears that that group was in fact setting off terrorist bombs, and they may very well have been functioning as agent provocateur, as people who are setting up an incident in order to justify the reaction to that incident. But again, looking at Marwan Krisat and his PFLP General Command and BND connections, it is suggestive of the hypothesis that I presented in the December surprise. Now, we're going to be taking a look at some information from the book Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris, and this is going to deal with the background to not only some of the key elements of Middle Eastern terrorism, but we're also going to take a look at Third Reich influence on Middle Eastern terrorism and a fellow named François Genoud, last name capital G-E-N-O-U-D. Now, again, this information is coming from a book called Unhealed Wounds. That's authored by a woman named Erna Paris, last name P-A-R-I-S. It was published by the Grove Press and copyright in softcover 1985. And in Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris, there is a good discussion of the fascist third position, a good discussion of Third Reich influence on Middle Eastern terrorism, and a good discussion of the involvement of the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the organization that Marwan Krisat was involved with this very same milieu. And that's what we're going to be looking at right now. Now, we're going to begin by reading a long section about François Genoud and his history. And again, Genoud here is the key individual. Genoud basically is the link between the past and the present. And we're going to be taking a look at a long section here, or several pages, of Erna Paris's Unhealed Wounds about François Genoud. Now, the main focus of this particular book is the career of Klaus Barbie, the SS man, the Gestapo chief for Lyon, France, during World War II, the Butcher of Lyon, who went to work as an intelligence agent for the United States at the end of World War II. We've taken a look at Klaus Barbie at considerable length in various archive shows. But in this particular book, Erna Paris goes into the post-World War II Nazi underground and its influence on Middle Eastern terrorism and the fascist third position in particular. Now again, François Genoud is the link between the past and the present. He is a thread that goes from the days of the Third Reich all the way up to the present and continues to be a main player on the international scene. Of François Genoud and his history, Erna Paris writes as follows. Back in Switzerland, Genoud made contact with Georges Ultramar, head of the Swiss fascist party L'Union Nationale. According to his own account, however, Genoud preferred the pro-Nazi Front National, which he joined in 1934. Oh, wait a second. Excuse me. I started a little too far in here. I'm going to backtrack a little bit and begin. I misread my own notations, of the history of François Jeannot. Now, in particular, you're going to hear here an individual named Jacques Vergès, last name V-E-R-G-E-S. Jacques Vergès was hired by François Jeannot, or apparently by François Jeannot, to become Klaus Barbie's counsel. He also was an individual who works with Jeannot in defending Middle Eastern terrorists. So again, jumping back here, we're the two names that we want to focus on, Jacques Vergès and François Jeannot. It was June 15, 1983. Jacques Vergès had become Klaus Barbie's sole legal counsel. Vergès merely smiled mysteriously when asked who was paying his fees and his expenses for trips to faraway places like La Paz, Bolivia, to collect evidence and interview witnesses. François Jeannot, on the other hand, was slightly less reticent. In an interview with Stern magazine, he said that he would neither confirm nor deny his involvement in the Barbie affair, adding that, quote, "everyone has his hobbies," unquote. Among Vergès's acquaintances, however, the answer seemed evident. "If Jacques needs money these days, he has only to go to Switzerland," confided a friend. It has long been known in various European circles that, quote, "a Swiss citizen who lives in Lausanne," unquote, has managed the Nazi treasury since the fall of the Third Reich. The money, most of which was stolen from European Jews, was deposited in numbered bank accounts through a clandestine club of former SS officers called Die Spinne, or the Spider, the successor to the Odessa organization. In March of 1965, Le Monde indirectly identified this individual as François Jeannot. In 1969, the Centre d'Information et de Documentation Moyen-Orient in Brussels confirmed the identification. François Jeannot personifies a hybrid of ultra-left and neo-Nazi extremism that first appeared on the international scene after the last war. One might even say he created the type, along with a handful of others. By the way, this aforementioned here, and I'm going to repeat the last sentence, this is basically the fascist third position. François Jeannot personifies a hybrid of ultra-left and neo-Nazi extremism that first appeared on the international scene after the last war. One might even say he created the type along with a handful of others. His Nazism came first. Jeannot was born in Lausanne in 1915 into a bourgeois family that appreciated law and order, unquote. In the early 1930s, before Hitler came to power, his parents sent him to Germany in hope that he would pick up some of the discipline of the emerging new regime. During his stay, Jeannot was introduced to Hitler and actually shook his hand. He read Hitler's writings and found them very relevant, quote-unquote. The teenager was an instant convert. François Jeannot returned to Switzerland a convinced Nazi and has never lost his faith. Back in Switzerland, Jeannot made contact with Georges Ultramar, O-L-T-R-A-M-A-R-E, head of the Swiss fascist party L'Union Nationale. According to his own account, however, Jeannot preferred the pro-Nazi Front National, which he joined in 1934. In 1936, he traveled to Palestine, where he met an individual who, like himself, would eventually combine the presumably polar opposites of fascism and extreme left-wing nationalism. Haj Amin al-Husseini was the ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and he was to become one of Jeannot's links to the Arab world. The Jeannot-Haj Amin al-Husseini link, very important here. In 1940, the military attaché at the French embassy in Bern, Switzerland, noted that Jeannot was involved in disseminating anti-French propaganda. Also around this time, Jeannot was contacted by an agent of the Abwehr for work in the German intelligence service, and during the course of the year, he disappeared from Switzerland to travel through Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Belgium. During this period, and immediately following the end of the war, Jeannot made the acquaintance of several extremely prominent Nazis, including SS General Karl Wolff, W-O-L-F-F. Wolff was Himmler's personal adjutant as far back as 1933, and in 1939 he became Hitler's liaison officer in the Führer's headquarters. In 1943, Wolff was supreme SS and police leader in the Italian campaign, and it was he who negotiated surrender on April 29, 1945. He was also part of Hitler's plan, later abandoned, to kidnap Pope Pius XII in September of 1943 after the fall of Mussolini with a special regiment of 2,000 men. Wolff was a consummate Nazi. According to a document submitted to the court at Nuremberg in 1946, he had greeted, quote, "with particular joy," unquote, the information that, again quoting, For 2 weeks now, a train has been carrying every day 5,000 members of the Chosen People from Warsaw to the killing center of Treblinka, unquote. In 1984, just before his death at the age of 84, Wolf gave an interview to a Swiss journalist in which he spoke of how much former Nazis everywhere owed to François Genoux. That last sentence again. In 1984, just before his death at the age of 84, Wolf gave an interview to a Swiss journalist in which he spoke of how much former Nazis everywhere owed to François Genoux. After the war, while they were in prison or in hiding, Genoux acted as an intermediary, Wolf said. In particular, he was involved in bringing aid to German soldiers and officers who were being held in French prisons. Genoux claims that he was not involved in helping Nazis escape from Europe, but only, quote, because the occasion did not present itself, unquote. I would interject, take that with a generous grain of salt. On another occasion, he explained himself further, this time with regard to Klaus Barbie. Quote, I did not help Mr. Barbie escape, unquote, he declared. It would not have been a dishonor to help National Socialists flee, but as it happens, I did not, unquote. As part of his ongoing commitment to the ideology of the Third Reich, Genoux became a publisher of important Nazi materials. He holds all posthumous rights to the writings of Hitler, Martin Bormann, and the Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, according to a financial agreement concluded with members of all three families in 1945 and 6. In 1952, representing himself as an agent of the Hitler family, Genoux brought charges against a Paris publishing house that had produced Bormann's account of Hitler's conversations without his permission and won. And in 1956, a court in Cologne agreed that he owned the rights to the posthumous works of Goebbels, causing a scandal among people who claimed that the royalties from such writings ought to be in the public domain to compensate Hitler's victims. In 1973, Genoux sold the rights to the Goebbels Diary, a 16,000-page manuscript with a Baroque history of its own, to Albrecht Naus, K-N-A-U-S, the director of Hoffmann und Kopp Verlag, a Hamburg publishing house, and in 1981, Naus, who by then had his own publishing house in Hamburg, brought out Hitler's political testament as purportedly dictated to Martin Bormann. The preface to the book explained that Genoux had acquired the document in 1946 at the time of the Nuremberg trials. It seems that ex-SS Captain Hans Reichenberg, who had the document, went to the Nuremberg trials to act as an advisor for the defense. There, through his former superior, General Hermann Rahmke, he met François Genoux, a friend of Rahmke, R-A-M-C-K-E. During the course of developing friendship, he confided to Genoux his photocopies of 18 chapters of the book. By 1955, Genoux's second career as advisor, researcher, and banker to the cause of Arab nationalism had begun. One of the keys to that seemingly unlikely transition can be found in Hitler's political testament. In the preface, Genoux explained that he planned to have the book translated into Arabic and Swahili because, in the body of the text, Hitler invited the people of the Third World to carry on the work of the Thousand-Year Reich. In 1955, Genoux was in Tangiers, one of the ports where Nazis seeking to escape European justice took refuge. He was also frequently in Cairo, where he worked in the Egyptian intelligence service under Nasser. Cairo under Nasser had become the center of the Pan-Arab movement since 1945. These were important years, the years in which Nazism and the developing ultra-left began to merge, and François Genoux was at the center of events. With his friend Hans Reichenberg, who also had discovered a new outlet for his career in the Arab world, Genoux created an import-export company called Arabo Africa. The business was primarily a cover for the export of anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli propaganda and the delivery of weapons to the Algerian FLN movement. Genoux made financial investments for various friends, Reichenberg and Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, Hitler's finance minister, among them. Genoux also renewed his friendship with Karl Wolff, who had found his way to Nasser's Egypt. Cairo in the 90s was paradise for Nazis with nowhere to go and nowhere to apply their carefully honed talents. In the emerging world of Arab nationalism, they found a new outlet for their profound anti-Semitism and their propaganda skills. It was in this milieu that François Genoux first met the nine leaders of the nascent Algerian insurrection, Ahmed Ben Bella, Ahmed Kider, K-H-I-D-E-R, Ait Ahmet, Mohamed Boudiaf, B-O-U-D-I-A-F, and their colleagues had formed the Provisional Government of Algeria. Cheneau's skills as a financier made him infinitely valuable, and before the end of the decade, he had established bank accounts in Switzerland on behalf of the North African Liberation Armies of Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria. The system he used involved multiple signatures, just like the system that was already in use for the secret Nazi funds. So before proceeding here with Erna Paris's account, let's take some time to review the central points of this particular passage. Now again, François Genoud, G-E-N-O-U-D, is a Swiss Nazi. He was a Swiss national who became an admirer of Hitler and a follower of Hitler. He works for the Third Reich in an intelligence capacity. In the mid-1930s, he hooks up with Haj Amin al-Husseini, the former Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who, as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 22, worked for the SS and became a key player in the post-World War II Palestinian terrorist movement, as well as the Palestinian national movement in general. Now, again, the association between Genoud and Haj Amin al-Husseini goes up through the years, and it breaches basically the pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II periods. It goes all throughout there, and that association was one of the key elements in helping to shape post-World War II terrorism. Now, note also, again, that François Genoud works for the Third Reich in an intelligence capacity. After the war, he becomes, to a certain extent, the banker for many of the funds secreted away by the various denizens of the Third Reich, by the participants of the Third Reich, both to ensure their protection after the war and also to help finance Nazi activities after the conclusion of hostilities, because there remained a very virulent post-World War II Nazi underground. Not only did the Nazis have a lot of time to plunder Europe and to stash the wealth away to finance post-World War II activities, but their incorporation into the national security establishment of the United States and other countries gave them a very real and contemporary political power base. So take a look at François Genoud's role again as a banker, one of the main bankers for the post-World War II Nazi treasury. Take a look also at his role in helping to publish many of the memoirs of key Third Reich officials, and also as the individual who published Hitler's political testament, or the individual in charge with the original manuscript purportedly documented dictated to Martin Bormann. And again, Hitler's political testimony, according to the information presented here, basically invited the people of the Third World to carry on the work of the Thousand-Year Reich. That's worth bearing in mind in connection with the fascist Third Position. And again, bear in mind the Skorzeny-Galen contingent to the Middle East in the mid-1950s. Now, we've taken a look at this in Radio Free America shows numbers 3 and 22 as well. Now, in the mid-1950s, shortly after Gamal Abdel Nasser overthrew King Farouk in Egypt, the United States wanted to establish friendly relations with Nasser at the same time it did not want to alienate Israel. Nasser, in turn, wanted to formalize his intelligence service. He had no real intelligence service, although he had a few intelligence operatives. He wanted to establish an intelligence service. He also wanted to establish a general staff. Basically, he contacted the United States and contacted Alan Dulles at the CIA. The CIA did not want to alienate Israel by sending regular CIA operatives, and in a sort of a strange twist, what they did was they, in turn, called on Galen, who sent a bunch of Third Reich alumni to the Middle East, to Cairo, which again was the center of the Pan-Arab movement since 1945, and there this group, which was headed up by former SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, and this group involved not only key SS and Gestapo veterans, but many war criminals of the first magnitude, this group set up the Egyptian intelligence service, they set up the first Egyptian general staff, and later this same contingent set up the Libyan secret service for Muammar Gaddafi in the late 60s. So again, in the mid-50s, Nasser turns to the CIA to set up his intelligence service, and the CIA, in turn, turns to Galen. Galen dispatches a bunch of key SS and Gestapo people, many of them notorious war criminals. They are headed up by Otto Skorzeny. They set up the Egyptian intelligence service and the Libyan intelligence service, and it is while this group is in the Middle East that they set up the first Palestinian terrorist groups which operated in the Gaza Strip. Because it's very obvious here, since François Genoux had very close ties with the Third Reich before, during, and after World War II, because he also worked for the Egyptian intelligence service, he obviously has to have worked with this group. And again, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 22, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the former Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, played a key role in the development of the Palestinian National Movement and their more extreme elements in particular. So those are the major points of this particular passage. Take a look again. Let's review them again. François Genoux works for the Third Reich in an intelligence capacity, hooks up with Haj Amin al-Husseini when both are working for the Third Reich. That association remains constant throughout the post-World War II years. Genoux works with the Skorzeny-Galen contingent in the Middle East, forming the Egyptian intelligence service. And Genoux also works as the post-World War II banker, not only for the post-World War II Nazi underground, but also for many of the emerging Middle Eastern nationalist movements as well, particularly the Palestinian National Movement, as well as the aforementioned FLN. That was the Algerian organization that was fighting on behalf of Algeria for independence from France during the Algerian War. Next, we move to Bandung, Indonesia in the mid-1950s, and we're going to see what happened to, at least to a certain extent, what happened to the Grand Mufti after the end of World War II. Bear in mind, this is, as we looked at in Radio Free America 22, this is a former SS major. In 1939, Amin al-Hussein, the ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, took refuge from the British, escaped to Germany, and attached himself and his followers to the Nazi cause. Heinrich Himmler, the SS chief, was delighted. It wasn't every day that a regiment of sympathetic Muslims joined the German war movement. Himmler respected the Mufti and often complimented him on his blue eyes, which he liked to describe as appropriately Nordic, unquote. But it was in a written tone to the Mufti that Himmler eventually struck a chord that would resound as a leitmotif for the future and survive four decades to influence the context of the Klaus Barbie affair. Quote, "The struggle against Judaism is at the very heart of the natural alliance between National Socialism and those Arab Muslims who burn with a desire for freedom," he wrote. "This alliance will endure until the final victory." In 1955, the Mufti resurfaced at the seminal conference of Bandung, Indonesia, where the idea of the Third World first took hold. 29 countries from Africa and Asia, representing more than one-half of the world's population, sent delegates to discuss common problems with an emphasis on colonialism. Among the Arab countries, however, hatred of Israel quickly emerged as a common theme. The representative from Iraq spoke of the force of evil, unquote, and called Zionism one of the blackest, most somber chapters in human history, again, unquote. Nasser had a few choice words to say in a similar vein. But the most surprising and convincing polemic of all came from Amin al-Hussein, who arrived on a surprise visit as the representative of Yemen, a country he had apparently never seen, and proceeded to reveal to the collected constituents that the real ambition of Israel was to annex the entire Middle East. So again, take a look here at the role of Haj Amin al-Hussein, or Haj Amin al-Husseini, the former Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, former SS major, in the emerging Third World Movement. And again, notice the kind of way, the direction in which he sought to influence it. Again, to a certain extent, his direction was successful. Now, we're going to jump from the mid-50s to 1969, and again, we're going to see François Genoux, we're going to see the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, we're going to see Third Reich alumni of the type that Otto Skorzeny was able to group together in the Middle East in the mid-1950s, and we're going to see this group beginning to combine with European neo-fascists, Italian and German fascists primarily, but European neo-fascists, some French as well, and they are in turn combining with Middle Eastern terrorist groups in order to represent what was later to become formally named the fascist third position. And again, it is this collaboration, Third Reich alumni, European neo-fascists and Middle Eastern terrorist groups, which we're looking at in the background of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. We're seeing evidentiary tributaries running in the directions both of the PFLP and the BND. And we're going to take a look here at where the PFLP, and again, for those people who may have forgotten, it is the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command that is being viewed as the most probable, as the agent of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. As we're going to see, this group is very closely affiliated with Third Reich elements after the end of World War II. Returning again to Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. Now again, we're jumping from the Bandung Conference of the mid-50s to the late 60s. In April of 1969, a Congress of the Neo-Nazi Neue Europäische Ordnung was held in Barcelona with 50 delegates from Europe and Latin America, most of them former SS officers, nostalgic Vichyists, and Franco supporters. By the way, Vichyist refers to French fascists who supported the pro-Nazi Vichy puppet government that ran much of France on behalf of the Third Reich during World War II. Continuing here with Erna Paris's account. The new European order had been a strictly Nazi-oriented outfit, but now, 15 years later, the focus of their international meeting was the Palestinians. Yasser Arafat sent a representative from El Fatah to explain the needs of the PLO and present two requests. The first concerned the need to recruit non-Arabs for sabotage operations, fundraising, arms supply, and the mobilizing of mercenaries and foreign instructors for training camps. The second request was for money for the dissemination of anti-Zionist propaganda in Europe and South America, including a wider distribution of the protocols. The El Fatah representative convinced several former Nazis to work directly for the cause. Karl van de Put, a Belgian who had served Germany in the Afrika Corps, offered to recruit young Europeans with military experience for El Fatah. Former Nazi officer Johann N. Schuller was already involved in arms sales to El Fatah. He had also begun to recruit former Nazi officers as instructors in El Fatah guerrilla training camps. Even the ubiquitous ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem turned up in discussion. It was announced that he had recently formed a new unit of sabotage. Again, that last sentence again. Even the ubiquitous ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem turned up in discussion. It was announced that he had recently formed a new unit of sabotage. Palestinian leaders began advertising in the Nationale Zeitung in Munich, asking for volunteer war correspondents with tank experience, unquote, to fight Zionist imperialism. By the late 1960s, satellite television was able to transmit events all over the globe, rendering the possibilities for propaganda almost limitless. Quote, "We think that killing one Jew far from the field of battle is more effective than killing 100 Jews on the field of battle because it attracts more attention," unquote, Dr. Habash confided several years later in an interview with Oriana Fallaci. That, by the way, is Dr. George Habash, last name H-A-B-B-A-S-H. Remember that name, because who does he work for? The PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, an organ of which is being fingered as the probable conspirator behind, or the main conspirator behind, the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Of Habash, Erna Paris writes, Dr. Habash confided several years... Oh, actually, let's repeat that last sentence. "We think that killing one Jew far from the field of battle is more effective than killing 100 Jews on the field of battle because it attracts more attention," Dr. Habash confided several years later in an interview with Oriana Fallaci. It is worth noting that he spoke of Jews and not Zionists as the targets of terrorism. Before 1970, his PFLP had hijacked several foreign planes in full view of an international audience and blown up four, killing Jews and Gentiles alike. So again, we're beginning to see the elements that we saw in the Third Reich. We're seeing François Genoux and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and we're looking at how they branch out into the post-World War II period. And now we're taking a look at how European neo-fascists, Third Reich alumni, the Grand Mufti, and Middle Eastern terrorists, including the PFLP, are beginning to band together in the fascist third position. We're going to take a look at François Genoux's role in this after a musical break in just a couple of minutes. So again, we're going to take a musical break here and then back with more of One Step Beyond. Good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. We're updating the December surprise, and we're going to proceed with information from Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. We've been tracing the career of François Genoux, a Swiss Nazi who worked for the Third Reich on behalf or in an intelligence capacity. We're looking at his association with Haj Amin al-Husseini, ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. We're following them both into the post-World War II period, and we're following in particular their role in helping to develop elements of third world political activism into the fascist third position. And in particular, we're taking a look at the influence of the fascist third position of François Genoux and company on Middle Eastern terrorism, because it is the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, an element of that being fingered as the culprit behind the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. As we've seen, a BND, a person working on behalf of BND, who was arrested and then later released, is being fingered as the probable person who put together this particular bomb that blew up Pan Am Flight 103. As we're going to see, the PFLP is inextricably linked with the post-World War II Nazi milieu, which intersects also with reactionary elements of our national security establishment. We're going to proceed now, again, with our look at the development of the fascist third position. And again, we've taken a look now at, in the late 1960s, we're seeing Third Reich alumni, Middle Eastern terrorists, and European neo-fascists combining into the fascist third position. We're going to take a look now at how not only the PFLP, but also the Mufti of Jerusalem fits into this particular situation. Resuming again with the information that, we are going to pick up again where we left off before. That's what I meant to say. Speaking now of the involvement of Jacques Vergès with the PFLP and with the Nazi milieu and the terrorist milieu that we have been looking at and are looking at here. Again, from Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. Given his passionate involvement with the cause of Arab nationalism, no one was particularly surprised to see Jacques Vergès resurface in 1965 as defense lawyer for Mohammed Hajazi, H-A-G-G-A-Z-Z-I, one of the first Al-Fatah terrorists apprehended in Israel. Since the sensational FLN trials, we're called, that's the Algerian National Movement, Vergès's reputation had grown considerably, and he was asked by Arafat to take on the Hajazi case and politicize it in his own way. In particular, the PLO leadership wanted him to hold an international press conference in which he would level accusations at Israel. Vergès agreed with some reservations, warning the PLO that he would be expelled from Israel if he followed such instructions. The leadership insisted nonetheless, Vergès gave his speech and he was expelled from Israel as expected. One day the following year, while idly flicking through a newspaper, Vergès happened to notice that the Hajazi trial was about to open the next day in Israel. Never one knowingly to miss out on the action or to let an opportunity for propaganda slip by, Vergès informed two people that he was leaving immediately for Israel, a reporter from Le Monde and the information officer from the Israeli embassy. "But you can't go there," shouted the information officer. "I'll take responsibility for that," replied Vergès. "You take responsibility for arresting me," unquote. Vergès was greeted by a police officer on his arrival at Tel Aviv airport and taken to a hotel for the night before being dispatched back to Paris. His every act was political, if not childish. He ordered a meat meal with milk to insult the Israelis whom he supposed were kosher in their eating habits. He insisted on having a bottle of Evian mineral water to remind those watching him of the Evian agreement between France and Algeria. A reporter from Haaretz stood under his window and called out, "A declaration, Maître Vergès." Vergès just happened to have a declaration prepared in which he attacked the State of Israel. He threw it out the window. The following morning in the airplane, the stewardess showed in the latest issue of Haaretz. Quote, "And that is how Hajazi learned about the PLO position on his trial," Vergès later recounted. Such abrupt comings and goings compelled a spokesman for the Israeli embassy in Paris to provide an explanation. Monsieur Vergès was more interested in propaganda than the defense of his client. In public declarations, he permitted himself to deny the existence of Israel and to defame the judiciary of our country, explained a spokesman. The propaganda mission, however, had been a resounding success. In December of 1968 and February of 1969, PFLP, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine Terrorists, hijacked El Al planes in Athens and Zurich, respectively, and at their subsequent trial in Winterthur, Switzerland, they chose Jacques Vergès as their legal counsel. Although he was once again refused permission to participate, Vergès went anyway as an outsider. Vergès went anyway as an advisor. Also present as an advisor, quote-unquote, was François Genou. Those last couple of sentences again, because here formally we're seeing Vergès, we're seeing François Genou and the PFLP, the group fingered in the Pan Am Flight 103 bombing, working together. In December of 1968 and February of 1969, PFLP terrorists hijacked El Al planes in Athens and Zurich, respectively, and at their subsequent trial in Winterthur, Switzerland, they chose Jacques Vergès as their legal counsel. Although he was once again refused permission to participate, Vergès went anyway as an advisor. Also present as an advisor was François Genou. The possibilities for propaganda at the Winterthur trial were too important to be left to amateurs. There were international press conferences, and an anti-Zionist brochure called the White Book was widely circulated. The defense was paid by the Banque Commerciale Arabe, which had by then adopted the Palestinians primarily on the recommendation of Ali Hassan Salameh, otherwise known as Abu Hassan, the leader of the Black September terrorist cell that was later responsible for the murder of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics. Abu Hassan lived in Switzerland, where he had established an easy friendship with François Genou. Interrupting here briefly, of course, in Radio Free America 22, we looked at Ali Hassan Salameh, not only his activities vis-a-vis the 72 Olympics, his work on behalf of the CIA, and the link-ups between his father and the Third Reich and Haj Amin al-Husseini. Worth noting here that Ali Hassan Salameh also on very good terms with François Genou. Continuing here. In 1982, Genou publicly acknowledged his deep involvement with El Fatah. In fact, he had long looked after their European operations from every point of view. He gave advice regarding the investment of huge amounts of money donated to the cause, not least from Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, who contributed $50 million to the PLO after the Munich assassinations. He provided legal counsel for Fatah men who needed help in Switzerland and underwrote other costs, including at least a partial subsidizing of a multinational terrorist organization that had set up shop in Paris, first under the leadership of Mohamed Boudia, who was murdered by the Israeli Secret Service in 1973, then under Carlos the Jackal. He was, in his own words, quote, an economic counselor with a special interest in the development problems of the Third World, unquote. Indeed, his interest in development problems, quote-unquote, led him to continue his business dealings as an arms merchant specializing in sales to the Palestinians. So again, we see Genou not only hooked up with Muammar Gaddafi, the same Muammar Gaddafi whose secret service was put together by the Skorzeny-Galen contingent mentioned above, who also, of course, worked with François Genou, the same Muammar Gaddafi who worked with Otto Skorzeny in bankrolling the Paladin Mercenary Group, a fascist mercenary group, which in turn is part of the Internationale Fascista. We've spoken about that in RFA's number 4. We came back to that in RFA 19. We've come back to that in RFA 22 and in RFA number 30 as well. It's worth noting here again that Carlos the Jackal, who, like Muammar Gaddafi, has contacts with the Triple Wilson team, the secret team that we've spoken about so often in the past. They also intersect with, that is to say, Carlos the Jackal also intersects with François Genou, just like Gaddafi. And again, we see these elements combining now into what eventually is to become the fascist third position. Now again, PFLP is one of the main elements we're focusing on here. We're going to continue to view this development and the PFLP's involvement with this milieu, including Jacques Vergès, including François Genou, in Erna Paris's Unhealed Wounds, continuing with that book. But it was 1982, before the connections between the Palestinian left and the Nazi right resurfaced anew, and once again Jacques Vergès was a principal player in the drama. So was his old friend François Genou. The case concerned the Paris trial of two terrorists known as the Friends of Carlos, quote-unquote. Bruno Breguet, B-R-E-G-U-E-T, a 12-year veteran of pro-Palestinian terrorist action, and Magdalena Kopp, formerly of the Baader-Meinhof band, had been intercepted by the Paris police while carrying grenades and guns and 4 kilos of explosives in a borrowed car that was parked just off the Champs-Élysées. Jacques Vergès was their lawyer and public apologist. Bruno Breguet had been on the terror circuit for more than a decade. In 1970, at the age of 20, the young Swiss had been sent by George Habash, Again, that's from PFLP. The young Swiss had been sent by George Habash to plant a bomb in the Israeli port of Haifa. He was caught with dynamite on his person and jailed in Israel. But the most intriguing fact about the young left-wing revolutionary was that he became a protege of his fellow countryman, François Jeannot, a Nazi. Jeannot later acknowledged his relationship with the PFLP. He corrected a journalist who had written he had no connection, quote-unquote, by saying he had no particular connection, quote-unquote, but had met Habash one or two times, again, quote-unquote. In 1970, when the original Bruno Breguet case broke in Israel, Jeannot, who was, in his own words, very available, traveled to Breguet's hometown of Tessin, Switzerland, to meet with the young man's family. They were lovely people, he recalled, with the mildness of a fond uncle. I tried to help them, quote-unquote. Help consisted once again of advice and the recommendation of a young lawyer who later became Jeannot's son-in-law. Again quoting, I was quite taken by the youth of this fellow citizen who had participated in this affair a little bit like a Boy Scout. At a time when so many young people didn't care about anything at all, he set off to do something interesting, recalled Jeannot. According to Le Monde, Jeannot paid for Breguet's legal costs and set up a support committee on his behalf. Given his relationship as a banker to the FLN and his connections with El Fatah and the PFLP, providing such financing was perfectly consistent behavior for Jeannot. And again, note the PFLP involvement here with Jeannot and company. Breguet was sentenced to 15 years in prison in Israel, but released after 7 following a vigorous publicity and lobbying campaign conducted by the Breguet Support Committee. His first free act was to visit Lausanne to thank his benefactor. Jeannot was vague about their subsequent relationship. I've seen him a few times since his release from prison. Sometimes he sends me a postcard, he allowed. Bruno Breguet resumed his activities. By the late 1970s, he too was involved in assisting the PLO in Europe through the Carlos Network. When the Breguet cop case came to trial in 1982, it was widely believed that François Jeannot had once again paid Breguet's legal costs with money that had, after all, been earmarked for aid to the Palestinian cause. Breguet was a member of the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and Jeannot was a longtime supporter of the same organization. Breguet had also lived in Berlin for a period during the 1970s, where he had easy access to the neo-Nazi groups that were dear to the heart of his benefactor. 10 years later, it became evident that Bruno Breguet and Magdalena Kopp worked in the same network. In February of 1982, Carlos sent a letter to the French embassy in The Hague demanding the release of Breguet and Kopp. You have arrested members of my organization, he wrote by way of information. Carlos gave the French government 1 month to accede to his request, but the letter was leaked to the press, and naturally the government refused. There was no hard evidence to connect the events, but 4 days after the deadline expired, a bomb exploded on the Paris-Toulouse train, killing 5 people. The following day, the French Cultural Center in Beirut was damaged. On April 15th, a French military officer and his pregnant wife were shot at point-blank range when they opened the door to their apartment in Beirut. On April 18th, 2 bombs exploded simultaneously in Vienna, one at the Air France head office, the other in the garden of the French embassy. So again, here we're seeing François Jeannot, and remember, he goes all the way back along with Haj Amin al-Husseini, an affiliate of the Third Reich before even World War II. They both, Haj Amin al-Husseini, that is, and Jeannot, become key players on the post-World War II terrorist scene, specifically in the Middle East, and Haj Amin al-Husseini, but more importantly, François Jeannot, work with the Skorzeny Galen contingent that puts together Nasser's and Gaddafi's secret services, and they go on to be key players in the uniting of Third Reich elements, European neo-fascists, and Middle Eastern terrorist organizations into the fascist third position. And it is, of course, with elements of this Middle Eastern terrorist milieu that the Turple Wilson Group, the secret team that we looked at in Radio Free America shows 4, 22, and 30, that it was with this group that they worked. And again, recall that George Bush, head of the CIA, when the Turple Wilson Group involving Messrs. Shackley and Kleins goes over to work with Gaddafi. And as we looked at in Radio Free America shows 4 and 22, that group was an official U.S. government mission. It was not an it was not basically a private mission at all. It was, as Ed Wilson claimed, an official U.S. government operation, in spite of disclaimers to the contrary. Now, the last item here that we're going to take a look at involves basically taking the same group all the way up to the present. And again, it is in this time period, 85-86, that we're looking at some of the key machinations vis-a-vis the Iran-Contra scandal. We're now going to be looking at events in Europe in the mid-1980s, and it was in this part of the world at this time that many of the events that bear directly on the Iran-Contra scandal were going on. And in particular here, we're going to take a look at Abu Abbas and his association with a German neo-Nazi named Otfried Hepp. Continuing with Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. By 1985, the alliance of the old-style fascist right and the new-style revolutionary left had become more visible. The seeds of Nasser's Cairo in the 1950s and the 1969 meeting of the New European Order in Madrid were bearing fruit. Recall, we've taken a look at both of those meetings earlier in the broadcast. In 1985, one of the left-wing Armenian terrorists, defended by Jacques Vergès, was found to be carrying a German passport that had been stolen by the neo-Nazi Hoffmann Group and distributed in a PFLP training camp in Lebanon. And in April of 1985, an important double arrest in Paris netted Otfried Hepp, H-E-P-P, the last member at large of the same Hoffmann organization in the company of a Tunisian member of the Palestine Liberation Front. Hepp was suspected of having planned and or participated in the anti-Semitic attack on Goldenberg's restaurant in Paris in 1982. Hepp, however, claimed to be a member in good standing of the Palestine Liberation Front Abu Abbas branch with its base in Tunis. According to Arndt Heinz Marx, associate president until his arrest in 1984 of the neo-Nazi National Socialist Front in Frankfurt, both Hepp and Marx trained in an Al-Fatah camp in Lebanon from July of 1980 until June of 1981 with a group of 15 German neo-Nazis. "I was a member of Al-Fatah, a Fedayeen," said Marx. "Al-Fatah and the PLO are fighting for the rights of their people as we are fighting for the German people. The Palestinians and ourselves have the same enemy, international Zionism and the Jews." Marx added that guerrillas training in Lebanon were not intending to attack Israel directly, but were preparing, quote, "for combat in Europe," unquote. As for François Genoux and his connections to both Nazism and the extreme left were evident and ongoing. In June of 1984, a Zurich newspaper pointedly reported that he had close ties with a Libyan embassy in Bern, and his own daughter Martine had been married to a revolutionary who was killed in internecine battle in Lebanon in the early 1980s.